So, Ms. Kiernan, we'll hear from you first. Would you care to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
I'm sorry, how much?
Three.
Three? Sure. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Good morning again, Your Honors. This is Elizabeth Kiernan, and this matter comes on the Commonwealth's appeal of the trial court's order suppressing evidence obtained following the conclusion of a lawful traffic stop.
Ms. Kiernan, would you address the motion to dismiss that was filed by Mr. Gardner? You may be ready to do that anyway, but that's something I think we need to deal with as well.
Sure. Regarding the notice of transcript?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. The Commonwealth, in this case, filed a notice of transcript outside the period of time prescribed by statute. However, this error by the Commonwealth, well, depending on which transcript you look at, it doesn't impact this court's jurisdiction because the petition for appeal was not untimely filed. Code Section 19.2405 clearly states that the petition has to be filed within
I suspect the issue is whether or not we can consider the transcript if it was not properly filed. And as I understand the issue, maybe you can speak to it. As I understand the issue, Mr. Gardner takes the position that the court reporter filing it even prior to the final order it binds the Commonwealth in doing that, even though, from what I can tell, the Commonwealth did not ask them to do that or otherwise ratify it, since they filed their own copy later. So it seems to me, I guess there's two questions. One is, what's the which is the case? Which, you know, does the filing time start running when anybody files, whether it's a court reporter or, you know, a counsel for the defendant or anybody? And if so, what effect does that have on to what degree we can consider the record?
Well, Your Honor, 19.2405 requires that the transcript be filed no later than 25 days following the entry of the final order of the court. And in this case, that was done. The transcript itself was timely filed and is properly before the court in this matter. I understood Mr. Gardner to be making a separate argument, which was that the petition for appeal wasn't timely filed because it should have been filed within the statutory amount of time from when a timely notice should have been filed. And as the court knows,
Ms. Kiernan, this is Judge Russell. It seems from the argument both in your reply brief and what you're making here that you seek to withdraw a concession that the Commonwealth made before your office became involved. In response to the motion to dismiss, the Commonwealth conceded that the petition for appeal in this case has not been timely filed if we accept that the court reporter's filing of the transcript was operative. It seems to me that you're trying to walk away from that concession. I just want to confirm that that's what you are, in fact, doing.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't believe the transcript, I don't believe that the petition for appeal would have been untimely filed by the logic advanced in the reply brief. However, the argument made by the Commonwealth's attorney is valid as well. The Commonwealth did file a second transcript in this matter. Perhaps they're not required to do so. However, the filing of that transcript does trigger new sets of guidelines. And I think the most important consideration here is that the transcript was filed within the 25 days provided for by statute. These timelines are meant to expeditiously move Commonwealth appeals.
That a little bit, because it seems to me both of those arguments contain an assumption that doesn't necessarily flow from the statute. The argument that you're raising that the petition for appeal is timely filed because it was filed within 14 days of the what could very well be considered an untimely notice of filing transcript. If you're correct in that, wouldn't that give the Commonwealth a unilateral right to delay the appeal for as long as they want?
No, Your Honor, and that's because of that 25-day requirement in the code section.
Well, if the transcript is filed within that statutory period, if you're correct that it doesn't matter when the notice of filing transcript is filed as to whether we attain jurisdiction or not, the Commonwealth could file the transcript and wait 3 months to file the notice of filing transcript, given your argument, and then as long as they filed the petition for appeal within 14 days of the three-month late notice of filing transcript, we would still have jurisdiction. I mean, that seems to be the logical import of your argument, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree. The code section expressly provides that the appellate rules still govern, and Rule 5A8 does address the effect of noncompliance with the rules for when a transcript has to be noted, and that's 5A8B4, the effect of noncompliance, which requires the non-appealing party to show prejudice. And in the case that the hypothetical Your Honor just gave me, the defendant would certainly suffer prejudice were the Commonwealth to act in that manner.
He would be subject.
And the effect there.
But wouldn't the prejudice there be he would be subject to a criminal prosecution, a continuation of a criminal prosecution, longer than the statutory deadlines would allow, which is the same prejudice he faces here. It's just the difference between one day and in my hypothetical, 59 days. So it's still prejudice. It's just a question of degree.
Yes, Your Honor. And if that were to be, in this case, though, we don't have that issue. We don't have that issue of prejudice. Both of the parties had the transcript, as the court has noted, before a final ruling even came down in this matter. And the Commonwealth did expeditiously file its transcript and notice of transcript within that initial period, and this appeal is before the court. The notice of transcript itself is not jurisdictional. What is jurisdictional is the petition, and that was filed within 14 days of the notice of transcript, which
this is Judge Humphreys again. What's the Commonwealth's position as to the effect of noncompliance with the time requirements for the notice of filing the transcript? Is there any consequence to that?
Well, Your Honor, the consequence, I believe, is in 5A8, or the potential consequence, rather. In this case, no, there is no consequence because no party suffered prejudice, and the transcript was timely filed and the petition was timely filed. The penalty for noncompliance with the filing of the notice of transcript, doesn't apply in this case because there was no prejudice. And there's been no prejudice alleged, nor I don't think on the record is there any prejudice apparent.
Well, then what would be the prejudice in my hypothetical? Because a potential prejudice in this situation is that the prosecution was extended longer than the statutory scheme allows. So my hypothetical of you holding the notice of filing transcript for 2 or 3 months after the deadline, then filing it, what would be the prejudice there that does not exist here?
Your Honor, I don't believe that I agree.
Well, looking at the statute, it's the phrase is in the requirement for the notice of filing to be made strikes me as being in context with the ability of a party to object any inaccuracy. So I would assume that the notice requirement is, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but it just strikes me that one obvious purpose of any notice requirement is to put the non-appealing party on notice that you, in this case, that a transcript has been filed, and if there's any inaccuracies or issues with it, it needs to be dealt with expeditiously.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that there is a set period of, I believe the non-appealing party only has 10 days to note, to bring that before the trial court and obtain a ruling on those matters. So to the extent that he would be unable to comply with his own set of statutory guidelines, there would be prejudice in that instance. Again, I would argue that there certainly was no prejudice in this instance because everything was filed within these guidelines.
And Ms. Kiernan, that gets to the second part of your answer that seems to me doesn't necessarily follow. It may, but it may not. And that is that because there's an outer limit of when a transcript can be filed, the 25-day limit, that means that the statutory period for when things are due can't begin to run before that period is exhausted. Because what do we call what the court reporter did with the transcript when she sent it to the court to be filed, the court accepted it, marked it filed, and the party parties had noticed that it was, in fact, filed. Isn't that filing?
Well, at that point, Your Honor, the parties had not decided to go forward with an appeal.
The
court reporters
appeal, but they had stated on the record that they were going to appeal. And Judge Humphreys asked you, and in your answer, Judge Humphreys had asked you about whether the Commonwealth, it does appear that they ratified the choice, the filing by the court reporter, but if that's going to be the Commonwealth's position, the 2014 amendments to the statutory scheme specifically struck by the Commonwealth, which seems to me to necessarily suggest that the filing by anyone could be operative. If you disagree with that, tell me why.
Your Honor, I do agree that the filing by anyone could be operative. However, I don't agree that that filing must be operative. The Commonwealth was entitled to review that transcript and see if they wanted to bring the matter before the court, maybe to correct inaccuracies that they saw in the transcript. There were no inaccuracies in this case, and they refiled the transcript themselves. They were not required to. They could have relied on the earlier finding, earlier filing by the court reporter, but again, they certainly weren't required to. And in this case, they filed a second transcript, which is not in violation of any of the rules. It was perhaps out of an abundance of caution. And if the court were to accept that second filing, then I think everyone is on board with the timelines running from there. We're certainly complied with. But to go back to Your Honor's question, and I hope I've answered your question, and perhaps Judge Humphreys, if I didn't understand what you were getting at the first time you asked me, I don't believe the Commonwealth is bound by that earlier filing, although they certainly could rely on it, and I think that takes care of the legislative history of this code section.
Okay, do you want to address the merits of the issue then?
Certainly, Your Honor. As the parties have noted, this case is substantially similar to the facts of a recent United States Supreme Court opinion in Rodriguez. However, this case calls upon the court to reach an issue not reached in Rodriguez. That is whether the police officer or the state trooper in this case had additional reason, lawful reasons to detain the defendant following the conclusion of the traffic stop. As we argued on brief, the trooper in this case had two discrete reasons to continue to detain the defendant. First, he had reasonable suspicion to believe the men in the vehicle were involved in criminal activity. And second, he also had probable cause to believe that unauthorized use of the vehicle, a violation of 18-2-102, was being committed.
How could there be probable? First of all, he released them on that. In other words, as I understand the record, he wrote them a warning for speeding and told them to be on their way, except that the guy who rented the car had to be the driver. So I don't understand how he can detain them ostensibly, or the Commonwealth's position is he's detaining them ostensibly to investigate unauthorized use when he's made it clear to them that, as far as he's concerned, that the investigation of that is over and they can be on their way with respect to anything having to do with the rental vehicle. So, I mean, how do you square that with what the trooper testified to?
Sure, Your Honor. Well, what the trooper was intending to do, whether he was intending to let them go with a warning on that or whether he was intending to continue to further investigate, the subjective intent of the trooper in that circumstance doesn't play into this court's determination of probable cause. The trooper did have facts sufficient to warrant his reasonable belief that unauthorized use of the vehicle was being committed. The unauthorized use, he had read the rental agreement, and unauthorized use requires the vehicle to be operating without the consent of the owner or outside the scope of the consent of the owner. And in this case, having read the rental agreement, he was aware that they are operating well outside.
Is that a crime that nobody's reported? In other words, the owner of the car, the rental company, didn't report any issue with respect. Of course, they may not have been aware of it, so I'm struggling, I'm looking at trying to quickly here. The trooper testified, I thought, that that he had no complaint from the vehicle's owner. I'm looking at page 73 to 75 of the joint appendix, and that he had never arrested anyone for unauthorized use of a vehicle under these circumstances, and no intent to charge Mr. Spinola with that offense. So, how does that square with a reasonable suspicion, much less probable cause?
Well, Your Honor, whether or not there was a complaint from the owner of the vehicle is not dispositive. Probable cause doesn't involve certainties. It wasn't required that he knew for certain that this vehicle was being used in an unauthorized manner. But given that it was being driven multiple states away from where it was supposed to be by someone who was not authorized to drive it, he was certainly reasonable in making that assumption. Whether or not he intended to arrest these men or would have arrested other men, again, is not dispositive because it goes to his subjective intent. He could have, and that's what's important here.
Ms. Kiernan and Judge Russell, I take it the Commonwealth will concede that getting the canine unit there would not help the officer in any way determining whether there was unauthorized use.
No, Your Honor, that's correct. I would agree with you there.
Doesn't it look...
Your Honor, he needs a reason to hold them longer. The canine sniff, as this court has noted and as federal courts have held, is not a search, a free air sniff of the car. What he needed in this case is a reason to detain them longer, and whether that detention was lawful could turn on probable cause or it could turn on reasonable suspicion. And in this case, there was certainly reasonable...
Judge Humphreys, probable cause for what? For an arrest or for a search?
For an arrest, Your Honor, for the unauthorized use of the vehicle, the reasonable suspicion of criminal activity.
No, you're mixing apples and oranges here. Let's start with probable cause. Is the Commonwealth's position that there was probable cause for the officer to make an arrest for unauthorized use of a motor vehicle based on this evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, okay. But he did not make such an arrest.
Correct.
So we don't have a search incident to an arrest situation here.
No, Your Honor.
So if let's assume that he has probable cause for an arrest. Let's for the purpose of my question, let's just assume he does. Then certainly any arrest is valid, but the search, if it's not a search incident to an arrest, which we don't have here, the search has to be supported by independent probable cause. Does it not under the law?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. However,
then we have a problem, don't we? At least as far as probable cause is concerned. I guess then we deal with reasonable suspicion.
Sure, Your Honor, yes. And I think that reasonable suspicion is potentially a stronger argument under these circumstances.
All right, let's talk about reasonable suspicion. Under Terry versus Ohio, the whole point of a Terry stop, assuming you have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, is to investigate the criminal activity you suspect is being committed, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, although
let's follow me along here, then.
Sure.
The Commonwealth asserts that the criminal activity suspected here is unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, correct?
No, Your Honor.
No? What criminal activity is being suspected here that was articulated?
Your Honor, the police officer isn't required to articulate what particular crime he's investigating them for. The reasonable suspicion.
Reasonable, articulable suspicion, and it's suspicion of criminal activity. The criminal activity is afoot.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that what Terry says?
Yes. However, the officer doesn't need to take the stand to say what crime in particular he was investigating them for.
He has to articulate facts that would lead any reasonable police officer to conclude that criminal activity is either in progress, has just occurred, or is about to occur. Isn't that what Terry says?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that. And in this case, he certainly had many indicators that there was something going on here, that criminal activity was afoot.
What I disagree with here
is that he's required to articulate which crime he would have charged. What's going on here is he's seeing men driving in a rental vehicle outside the scope, and this is not, to be clear, the probable cause argument is an argument in the alternative. He had reasonable suspicion of criminal activity as an alternative argument.
You're not suggesting that it's reasonable suspicion to be nervous in the company of a police officer, are you?
No, Your Honor, that's one of multiple factors, and this is the totality of the circumstances.
Let me cut to the chase here. Terry versus Ohio, unlike Wren versus the United States, which permits a whole lot of things to occur if there's probable cause, under Terry, all you can do is briefly detain an individual for the purpose of investigating the criminal activity you suspect is either occurring or about to occur. And,
yes, Your
Honor. And Judge Russell raised the point of how does a drug dog further the investigation of the criminal activity the officer here has suspected or articulated reasons for suspecting has occurred. And the Commonwealth keeps pointing to the unauthorized use situation, but how does a drug dog further that investigation?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it does. And again, those are separate arguments. I would argue that he had reasonable suspicion that they might have been involved in criminal activity. He's on the highway interdiction task force.
Ms. Kiernan?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. If we get to a position where just reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity with no specification of what criminal activity it is, just generalized, how does that not become just the hunch that isn't supported by reasonable, articulable suspicion? They're not allowed to just go on a hunch. If you can't articulate the particular crime that you think might be being committed, how is that anything other than just a hunch? It may have been a good hunch. It may be an educated hunch. Turned out it was a correct hunch. But how do we move from an impermissible hunch to reasonable, articulable suspicion if all we have is generalized criminal activity is suspected?
Your Honor, I apologize for being unclear with this. My argument was merely that the officer doesn't have to articulate on the stand what it was he subjectively was investigating. I think from the record and viewing this as we must objectively now, it's clear that he had reasonable suspicion that there might have been some kind of narcotics activity afoot, which is why he brought in the dog. He has men on the known drug corridor driving this rental car. Importantly, they give him inconsistent stories about where they've been. They tell him, one tells him that they've been in Georgia for the weekend. The other says, I've been in Myrtle Beach for the past 3 or 4 days. He doesn't know what state Myrtle Beach is in, despite the fact that his daughter lives there. The other gentleman, Mr. Sinola, who's the defendant in this case, is visiting a friend, Unc, but he doesn't really know where he lives. Neither of them had specifics about where they've been. Those inconsistent stories given to the state trooper, in addition to what he perceived as excessive signs of nervousness and tenseness on the part of the driver, in addition to his experience with rental cars being driven up and down the 95 corridor, those factors considered together, particularly in light of his experience as a 10-year veteran of the state trooper force, gave him reasonable, articulable suspicion, and he did articulate all those factors, that criminal activity was involved, and he then reasonably detained these men for approximately 2 minutes in order to confirm or dispel his suspicions. He got a drug dog there right away, and I believe it was a two minute and 10 second, maybe, depending on when you count from. That's on App 94 detention to confirm or dispel his suspicions. And that's exactly what Terry requires, and that's exactly what he did in this instance. It doesn't matter whether the men may have had an innocent explanation for what they were doing, just as the men in Terry could have been window shoppers, just as the person in Rab versus Commonwealth cited on our brief could have been a restaurant employee late in the parking lot. The police aren't required to know what's going on.
One of the problems I have with your summary of the factors that amount to reasonable suspicion is, of course, the standard of review. In this situation, unlike the usual situation the Commonwealth finds itself in, we have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party below, which was not the Commonwealth. So it seems to me some of those so-called facts that you point to were rejected by the fact finder. For example, the if I can find it here, I thought the trial court
questioned the nervousness of the.
I'm sorry. Yes, exactly. So, I mean, to whatever extent the facts you articulate were rejected by the fact finder as, you know, not being credible, we're bound by that finding as well. So I think you need to be careful how you argue this, because we do have the standard review we're bound by.
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand it. And our position would be the trial court did not make an express credibility determination or necessary factual finding.
Rejected any notion of reasonable suspicion and probable cause, although I do note the final order only addresses probable cause, but in her oral ruling from the bench, she addressed both.
Yes, Your Honor, and specifically the court said that weighing all of these things, she didn't find that they amounted to reasonable suspicion. And that is a legal determination, and that this court can rule de novo. The court didn't find that they were not nervous, didn't find the trooper wasn't credible. She simply weighed all of these factors and found they didn't amount to reasonable suspicion, and that's on Appendix 127. That's a legal determination. Again, I understand the standard of review this court is working with. However, I do believe the trial court weighed those factors incorrectly in this case, and that was reversible error. I apologize, Your Honor, but my timer has died on me.
Well, no, your time. Well, you've gone over your time, but
I've kind of figured.
I gave you extra time because of all the questions about the motion that was made, so I'll still give you your 3 minutes in rebuttal.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Unless the court has further questions, I will allow the other side to go for a little bit.
All right. Mr. Gardner?
Yes, sir. Thank you. May it please the court, Mrs. Mark Gardner on behalf of Mr. Spinola. Just briefly, unless you tell me it's not necessary, the procedural default issue, I think, I don't know how it can be construed otherwise. The practice, I think we all know, is that court reporters routinely file the transcripts with the clerk of court. That's what happened in this case, and it's no surprise because at the hearing, when the judge announced her ruling, the Commonwealth immediately stated its intention to appeal, which triggered the responsibility.
Mr. Gardner, Judge Humphreys, let me interrupt you a little bit and ask. There's a whole line of cases. I mean, I can think of probably at least a half a dozen of them off the top of my head from both our court and the Virginia Supreme Court that basically stand for the proposition that when we're dealing with an appeal, it's the burden is on the appealing party to provide a record to us. Do you disagree with that proposition?
No, sir, of course not.
Then certainly the statute doesn't expressly alter that, although I guess you might be able to make an argument to that effect implicitly from the fact that the words the Commonwealth were removed in an amendment. But my point is simply we typically also don't construe statutes in a way that achieve absurd results by frustrating the purpose. And the Commonwealth has been granted a very limited right to appeal. And it seems to me if we were to adopt your argument that any time anybody files something, it starts the clock running against the Commonwealth, even if they don't, even if that individual, the court reporter in this case, doesn't act as their agent or it isn't ratified or adopted later by the Commonwealth, that a clever attorney, and I'm not suggesting you would do any such thing, but a clever defense attorney might try to frustrate the Commonwealth's ability to appeal by running down and filing a partial transcript, you know, getting a court reporter to type up one page or something, file it, start the clock running, not notify the Commonwealth about it, and the next thing you know, the Commonwealth's time has run out under your, I guess if we extend your analysis to that ultimate conclusion. How would you respond to that?
Well, I appreciate what you're saying. Obviously, those factual circumstances that you've outlined are not present here. And I think if you had those factual circumstances, the logical argument would be, well, that's not a transcript. But I don't think you can overlook the fact that 19.2.405 states alternative deadlines for filing the notice of filing transcript. Within 3 days of filing the transcript, or not later than 14 days after the order is entered, whichever is later. If that language means anything, it contemplates that a transcript could be filed, and not necessarily by the Commonwealth. And further, it makes no sense to just leave it up to the Commonwealth to file the transcript when it's prepared to do so. That frustrates the whole statutory scheme, which is to expedite these appeals.
Mr. Gardner, going to Judge Humphrey's hypothetical of the one page of the transcript.
Yes, sir.
Would your position be different in this case if that had happened and the Commonwealth said, later filed the entire transcript and said, no, we're not relying on the one page, we're filing additional documents that we have a right to file. So we're filing a whole copy of the transcript, while in this case, all they did was refile file a document that had already been filed.
Yes, I would have to agree that a one-page transcript is simply a portion of the transcript necessary for the appeal and does not represent what's contemplated by the statute.
Well, again, let me follow up on Judge Russell's question, because it seems to me that, again, we depend on the appellant to provide us with the record, and it's up to them to choose how much of the record they want to provide us. And if they choose unwisely and don't provide us with enough of the record for us to reach the merits of the issue, well, then shame on them. They're basically out of luck, because without the transcript, or at least the complete transcript, we may not be able to reach that issue. On the other hand, the issue may be narrow enough that a partial transcript would suffice for us to do that. And so basically, you pay your money and you take your choice if you're the appellant, and you select how much of the record you want to file. Now, of course, the other side can supplement that if they choose to in most cases. So I guess what I'm getting at is we're trying to construe this language from the General Assembly. We certainly don't want to do it in such a way that there are unintended consequences that are going to come back and haunt everybody later on. And so, obviously some of these hypotheticals we're posing have some absurdity to them, but we live in a world where these absurdities come to pass eventually if we're not careful. So I guess, getting back to Judge Russell's point that he raised, I guess I'd ask for your comment on, if hypothetically someone were to file a partial transcript and not advise the Commonwealth about it, and the clock starts running, and that deprives the Commonwealth of their right to appeal because through no fault of their own, because somebody acted without notice to them. And by the way, I think the notice requirement must be, as it usually is the case, is designed to simply apprise the opposing party of what's going on so they can respond and correct if necessary, or supplement if necessary, to make sure their points are heard on appeal. So, if that's the purpose and that purpose isn't frustrated, why wouldn't any error, if it exists, be harmless?
Well, the reason I submit that it's not harmless is the filing of the transcript and the notice of filing of the transcript are key to the deadline for filing the petition for appeal. And Rule 5A:3A states that the filing deadline for the petition is mandatory. If the time for filing the petition for appeal by the Commonwealth in this case runs from their filing the notice of transcript, and they can control what date they pick to file the transcript, even when one complete transcript has been previously filed, that frustrates the whole statutory scheme. I don't see how it can be interpreted that way when the purpose of it is to give the Commonwealth a narrow right of appeal, recognize that the criminal charge is still pending, and that it has to be expedited.
Well, and would leave us with this situation that you would never know for a transcript filed, that when a transcript is filed before an order is entered, you'll never know whether the deadline is the 3 days or the 10 days until 25 days after the order, because you won't know if the Commonwealth will file a duplicate copy of the transcript 25 days later.
Yes, sir.
I do have, and I apologize, given that most of our cases dealing with this are unpublished, if you're not familiar with it, I apologize.
Okay.
But in Commonwealth versus Hackett, this court found that the shall, as far as shall certify, or a panel of this court, found that the shall in shall certify that the appeal is not entered into for purposes of delay, that portion of the statute, that shall was not mandatory and was merely directory. If we apply that logic to the filing deadlines, obviously if it was merely directory, it's not jurisdictional. What is your response to that at least this court, panels of this court have held that at least some of the shalls are merely directory?
No disrespect intended by my reaction. I'm sorry I'm not familiar with Hackett, and maybe it's a simplistic view, but I've always operated on the assumption that when the court in its rule or the legislature in a statute uses mandatory language, it means what it says. I forgive me because I'm not familiar with Hackett, but My position would be that when the rule states the deadline is mandatory, it means that. When the legislature says shall be filed not later than, that doesn't seem like an aspirational goal. It seems like a dictate. And there should be. You know, this hurts defendants when the table is, when the shoe's on the other foot. If we don't meet those deadlines that are clearly established and there for good reasons, there are consequences for it. It shouldn't be any different when the Commonwealth happens to be the appellant.
Mr. Gardner, if the Commonwealth had done everything exactly the same,
yes, sir,
as far as filing the notice of filing transcript when it did, and we find that that's late, but it filed the petition for appeal a day earlier. So coincidentally, it would have been filed, what, 9 days after the notice of filing transcript, but it would have been within the time period if the notice of filing transcript had filed timely. Would the petition be properly before us?
In fairness, I would have to say yes. I don't think the language on the notice of filing transcripts is as clearly mandatory as is the language determining or mandating that the petition for appeal be filed timely. So under your under that scenario, had they filed it a day earlier, I certainly think their argument would be much stronger that it was timely filed.
Mr. Gardner, do you want to address the merits of this at all?
I would be happy to. I don't want to impose if you all don't feel like I need to, but I would certainly be happy to.
That's entirely up to you. You have I gave your opponent some extra time. You haven't even used all of your time yet, so you've got a few minutes left if you want to use it.
Please let me do that. First of all, with respect to the issue of probable cause for the unauthorized use, I don't think it can be ignored that the trooper involved in this case abandoned, it's unequivocal in the record that he abandoned any concern or issue about or any pretense of conducting any investigation of that possible offense. He handed Mr. Spinola his license back and suggested to him that he might want to look into those, what the trooper continually called discrepancies. And then, after doing that, he never returned to that issue. He never made any attempt to call the owner of the vehicle to find out if there was any problem with the use outside the territorial limits. And he never conducted any sort of investigation of it. That's nothing more than an after-the-fact creative attempt to justify the detention, but the detention continued before the dog arrived and after he handed Mr. Spinola his license back and raised no further question about unauthorized use.
Mr. Gardner, regarding the circuit court's order that specifically limits its finding to there being no probable cause, recognizing, as Judge Humphreys pointed out, orally she may have said more than that.
Yes, sir.
The order itself is in error, is it not? I mean, reasonable they didn't need probable cause to extend the stop. They only needed reasonable articulable suspicion, correct?
I agree with that, yes, sir. I think it's very clear when you look at what the judge said before the order was written. Both parties were arguing both reasonable articulable suspicion and probable cause as alternative bases for the detention. The judge addressed them both. But I would agree the order, there's a clerical, I would call it a clerical error in the order because it mentions only probable cause.
I don't know
but
how
it
many
certainly adopts the court's rulings.
Are you suggesting that it's mere harmless error if it is error?
Yes, sir. Well, the reason I say that is the court clearly addressed the reasonable articulable suspicion argument and then memorialized the rulings that were articulated at the hearing by way of the order. The order, you may be correct that the order fails to state her finding, which she articulated verbally at the hearing, but I don't think we're bound by that. Uh, Just finally, with respect to the issue about reasonable articulable suspicion, the cases say that that requires a particularized and objective basis for suspecting criminal activity. The court looked at the video. The video itself does not support the conclusions that the trooper made when he observed what he describes as excessive nervousness, the driver's trembling voice, the driver constantly rubbing his forehead. Those are things that you can see for yourselves on the video are not supported by the video recording of what happened. And even if all of those were taken at face value, how can it be said that that reasonably articulates a basis to believe that criminal activity is afoot? It causes an officer's antenna to go up and to ask questions. I understand that. But surely it's not enough to justify a detention when there's the officer and the Commonwealth can't even articulate what the crime might have been. So I respectfully submit that there's a procedural default, but if there isn't, on the merits, the court should uphold the ruling of the circuit court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Ms. Kiernan?
Yes, Your Honor. Briefly, I think what the court has pointed out to both parties here is that we're working with perhaps an imperfect statute that regulates Commonwealth appeal. There are arguments on both sides that do lead to absurd results. However, I think it's important in this case to note that the record, the jurisdictional elements have been met. The transcript was filed. There is a record before this court for the court to reach the issue, and also that the petition was timely filed.
Excuse me, Judge Humphrey, let me ask you the question I put to your opponent then. Let's assume that, following up on Judge Russell's hypothetical, let's assume that the General Assembly clearly intended that anyone who files the transcript starts the clock running to the detriment of the Commonwealth. And let's assume then further that as a result of that, the notice of the filing is not timely made by the Commonwealth. What is the sanction or what is the remedy for that as you read the statute? And I guess and that presupposes that it's mandatory as opposed to directory. And you may have a position on that as well, but let's assume that it's mandatory. What would be the appropriate sanction? Would it be to toss the transcript? I mean, typically that's what when there's defects in the filing of a transcript, we don't dismiss the appeal because as you point out, it's not jurisdictional. But it would limit our ability to consider what's in the transcript.
Correct, Your Honor, but what we're looking at here is not a defect in the record. This is a notice that the record has been filed. And I don't think the code section provides a remedy for that. We have to look back to 588, which the code contemplates that the general appellate rules govern in these circumstances. And for there to be a penalty in these cases, 588B4 says that the non-moving party has to show material prejudice. And that would be the remedy that's available for a late filing of notice of transcript. There was no material prejudice in this case. So in this case, I would say that there is no penalty for noncompliance. There may be in other cases under other hypotheticals, but as long as those jurisdictional elements do get filed on time, the notice of transcript, the penalty for noncompliance, is prescribed by the rules, and in this case, it's not applicable as there was no prejudice. Furthermore, Your Honor, just to briefly touch on the issue of reasonable suspicion, it's worth noting both parties have agreed that this case is very factually similar to the result in Rodriguez. The defendant argued on brief that it controlled. I think it's worth mentioning that in Rodriguez, the dissenting judges, I believe all of them, would have found reasonable suspicion in that case under substantially similar circumstances. Reasonable suspicion is a low bar. I know we spent a lot of our time talking about the probable cause on the unauthorized use issue. But what we have here, reasonable suspicion of criminal activity as a separate argument for drug activity in this case, there was enough information there for the trooper to articulate reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot. and to the extent the trial court viewed the video herself and made her own determinations regarding the nervousness of the occupants of the vehicle, that was also an error because the court needs to be looking at this from the perspective of a reasonable law enforcement officer, not the court's perspective. The court has not accomplished 100 criminal interdictions as this trooper has. It's the trooper's experience that is relevant, and to the extent the court did not place appropriate weight on the trooper's experience and what these facts meant to a reasonable trooper under these circumstances, that was also an error. And I thank you for allowing me time to conclude, Your Honor. Does the court have any further questions?
Apparently not. So, Ms. Karen, Mr. Gardner, we appreciate your arguments today, and the court will now adjourn the conference.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You're welcome.